Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, our performing arts monthly program dedicated to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. This month, we'll join the commander and conductor of the U.S. Air Force Band of Mid-America as he outlines the Midwest Winds Woodwind Quintet's early February concerts across the state. We'll speak with rising star soprano Sydney Mancasola about her upcoming Des Moines recital. We'll chat with internationally acclaimed pianist Andre Watts about what he will perform on his January 31st concert. We'll hear from the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's guest stage director William Ferrara about the CROT's approaching Don Giovanni production. And we'll find out what famous judge is attending the Metropolitan Opera National Council Iowa District's auditions this year, as well as hosting a masterclass to be held next weekend on the Iowa State campus. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
It is marvelous. It's a wonderful day. I mean, you hear everything from Mozart to Jake Heggie, and all your favorite arias, all your favorite operas will be represented, pretty much guaranteed, because it's such a fun afternoon, and there aren't a lot of opera houses in Iowa. Certainly, we have a few fine opportunities to hear wonderful opera, so we'd love to have people come and give opera a try. It's a wonderful time for people who know and love our opera to hear their favorite arias over and over again, or hear new arias. It's also a wonderful time for people who just want to dip their toe in the water to come hear, you know, just one or two singers and see, like, what's this all about? It's a nice time to get to know the artists. Once the competition winds up and all singers have had an opportunity to sing their two arias and the judges are deliberating, there'll be a nice little reception and an opportunity to chat with the artists and get to know these singers. So you might be chatting with the next John Osborne or the next Renee Fleming, or and certainly our audience members do get to know these singers and kind of feel a part of their career and watch them as they grow and move through their careers. It's free for the public, and we encourage everyone to come and enjoy.
Sarah Compton, Iowa State Center's Outreach Coordinator, talking about next weekend's Metropolitan Opera National Council Iowa District auditions. Sarah lightheartedly calls them the American Idol for opera. Sarah, along with Iowa State's Professor of Music and Voice Division Chair, Dr. Don Simonson, enthusiastically fill us in on the impact and long history behind the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions.
This is the 62nd year of the auditions. They actually began in Minneapolis 62 years ago and then went nationwide.
And then prior to them arriving in Ames, they were held in Des Moines. I remember when I was a student at another university to the south of Iowa State, they were usually held at Hoyt Sherman Place. And then for a number of years, they went down south, even further to Simpson College. They've been here in Ames for nearly 20 years, I think. And we're thrilled to have the opportunity to have these gifted singers come to Ames. It serves us in a number of ways, and one in giving an opportunity for our students to come and listen to these fine singers, and then also providing an opportunity for us to bring people into Music Hall and people from the community and people from the state and give them the opportunity to hear the fine, fine singing that occurs in Iowa. So we're very thrilled with that aspect of it.
What is the purpose of these Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions?
Well, the purpose is quite simply to find exceptionally talented opera singers and to give them a leg up in their career development. Judges principally listen to the auditions with an ear for operatic potential and exceptional quality, range, and charisma, the ability to communicate, and just the natural beauty of the voice. So the people that come to Ames sing here, and with the three judges listening intently to them and their backgrounds and experiences, pick out those voices that they think exhibit those qualities, where the winners then of the Iowa District advance on to the Upper Midwest Regional Competition, which is held in St. Paul. Now, after they go to St. Paul, Again, another winner is selected from that group, and that individual then goes to New York City, where up to five of them receive $15,000 stipends and have the opportunity to then sing with the Met Orchestra in the grand finale on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera, where winners are chosen following that.
There have been several Iowans who have had that opportunity and honor. Tell us about a few of those.
Well, the first one that I remember coming through was John Osborne. And John was a Sioux City native, came through, his beautiful lyric tenor voice. And John sang so stunningly. But the real story was that John was advancing to the Upper Midwest Regional Finals and didn't own a suit. And the prize that he was awarded by the Iowa District bought him a suit, which took him to the Upper Midwest Regional, and along with a stunning instrument, mature performer, led him to win the Upper Regional and then to advance on to New York, where he was one of the winners and quite frankly is having a wonderful career to this day and going further and going farther in his career than I think he may have thought was possible when he came through the Iowa District auditions. John Moore, another young man who advanced through the Iowa District, and Ted Green, those are three that come to mind right now. Iowa has a pretty rich history of putting excellent singers forward, then advance through the regional auditions. Those are just three of the more recent ones.
Was Eric Cutler one of the ones who went?
Yes.
Yes, of course Eric was. Eric is having a marvelous career and was one who advanced through Iowa. I think Eric may have been one of the first to advance through Iowa after the time when you had to have a regional affiliation with the district to be allowed to compete in it. And that lasted for a long, long time, probably for 45 or 50 years. But now each district is open to anyone from anywhere to come and audition. So we have lost a little regional tie. But if they advance through Iowa, they're unofficially our people.
Many, many of our singers do have Iowa ties. Just the geographic restriction has been lifted because we are such a mobile society and because these singers are in budding careers now, so they audition where they can, when they can, when their schedules allow, and things like that. So they do, many of them have Iowa ties. So we do have a lot of good Iowa music.
Tell us about the judges that will be at this year's competition.
At this point in time, we have one judge who has committed to come, and that is George Shirley from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Now, George Shirley was a winner of the Metropolitan Opera National Council and was the first African-American tenor to sing at the Metropolitan Opera. He was the second African-American. And so we're thrilled that George is going to be joining us and following the auditions, he will also take on another role that he will provide a master class for any of the competitors at the Iowa District on Sunday. I believe we're going to start that about 10 o'clock, and that will go for 3 hours and is also open to the public. So we would like to invite anyone who would like to see and hear these young singers work with a gifted master teacher. Mr. Shirley is a professor emeritus from the University of Michigan School of Music and just recently was presented with the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Association of Teachers of Singing. He's a wonderful, wonderful man, and a kinder heart doesn't exist when it comes to working with young singers. And we're thrilled to have him here because he is such a personable man, willing to give back everything that he can to the profession that has been so good to him.
Yes, and that's one of the other benefits of the Metropolitan Opera auditions is the interaction with the judges. The singers not only sing for the judges, but also have an opportunity to communicate with the judges and receive feedback following the auditions. So in addition to working with Mr. Shirley the following day, and certainly not everyone will be able to sing for him in that three-hour time span, but the singers do all get a chance to communicate with the judges and receive feedback, and they get some valuable feedback sometimes, even job offers and study offers and professional advice and those kinds of things that can be really career-changing for these young singers. So it's a wonderful opportunity.
What do the young singers have to sing at this competition?
5 arias representing different languages and styles, different periods, but there's no pedigree. They need to be between 20 and 30 years old, and they need to have arias from which to choose. But other than that, there's no firm pedigree needed.
And neither is the repertoire specified. It has to be repertoire that is appropriate for their voice and that shows off their instrument to its best advantage.
So why is it so important to have these auditions?
Well, the Metropolitan Opera is perhaps the pinnacle of operatic performance in the world, not just in America. And these auditions provide an opportunity for American singers coming from every part of this country to have their voices heard, to be given the opportunity to show what they're made of musically and vocally and technically and artistically. And I think since opera isn't nationalized in America as it is in many European countries, this opportunity to sing and to be recognized by the Metropolitan Opera is an opportunity for the finest of American talent, of American performance ability, of American vocalism and vocal technique to be showcased. And I think if you look worldwide, American singers maintain their position in the world as perhaps the best trained, the best prepared, and the most adaptable and malleable to the great diversity of vocalism necessary to have a career in opera. And there are so many winners who have gone through the program who may never have ended up with a career at the Metropolitan Opera, but are singing all around America and all around the world. So it really serves not only its own function, but it is a benchmark that many opera houses around the world, not only in America, employ to find that talent pool.
Sarah, you're adding something new this year to the auditions. Tell us about that.
We are indeed. We're excited that we will roll out this year for the first time an audience favorite award. You know, everyone does it. Everyone says, well, what did you think of that singer? I liked this one. And this time we're going to give people the chance to vote for their favorite. It's unrelated to the actual competition in that the singer will not necessarily advance, though if the audience chooses one of the same singers that the judges choose, that singer, of course, will receive double the accolades. But the audience choice award will just be a small monetary award and just recognition that they really connected and communicated with the audience. And that's, after all, what the art form is about.
Sarah Compton, Iowa State Center's Outreach Coordinator, along with Iowa State's Professor of Music and Voice Division Chair, Dr. Don Simonson. In addition to having Mr. George Shirley as one of their distinguished judges and masterclass coach, they will also be hosting Rick Walters of Hal Leonard Publishing as one of their judges. ISU's Jody Goble will serve as collaborative pianist. The Metropolitan Opera National Council Iowa District Auditions will start at noon next Saturday, January 10th at the Martha Ellen Tye Recital Hall on the ISU campus in Ames. Following the auditions, there will be a reception for the audience and the singers. All events are free and open to the public. To learn more, please visit center.iastate.edu/MONC. Iowa State is also hosting their 50th annual ISU Madrigal Dinners. The Saturday, January 17th performance is sold out, but there are still tickets available for Friday evening's show at the Great Hall of the ISU Memorial Union. For details, please see music.iastate.edu/events/madrigaldinners. Just ahead, the dazzling soprano Cindy Mancasola talks about her recital next weekend. Celebrated pianist Andre Watts shares about how his career was launched. The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's guest stage director, William Ferrara, talks about Mozart and Don Giovanni. And the commander and conductor of the U.S. Air Force Band of Mid-America Scott Air Force Base, Captain Jason Plosh, discusses the Midwest Winds Woodwind Quintet's upcoming Iowa concerts. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
We are proud to be full-time airmen and musicians in the United States Air Force and to represent all the men and women all around the world that serve their country. And we have chosen, we've all volunteered to support our country through the power of music while wearing the uniform. And I say to a lot of our live audiences, because we are in uniform, and I say, don't let the haircuts and uniforms fool you. We're all hippie musicians at heart. We're just very proud to be able to spread that message and bring the military and the goodwill and the service, especially in February, to the people of Iowa.
The commander and conductor of the U.S. Air Force Band of Mid-America, Captain Jason Plosh, talking about the mission of enlisted musicians in the U.S. Armed Forces. A Clinton native, Captain Plosh shares details about his professional experience.
My background is in music. I attended the University of Iowa for my undergrad and Penn State for a master's degree, both in music and music education. And prior to joining the United States Air Force, I worked for Disney, both in California and in Tokyo, worked on cruise ship, and I taught public school, high school instrumental band in Centerville, Iowa for 3 years. So I kind of paid my dues a little bit, but I had off and on taken a few military band auditions on trumpet, and then I finally, in 2001, enlisted in the Air Force as a trumpeter.
And then through a series of different things, you went to Operation Iraq and Freedom Iraq and all of these?
That's true. Brass Quintet, back in 2007, Wright Brass Quintet out of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We deployed Thanksgiving through Christmas through New Year's into 2008. We were the very first brass group to deploy to the Middle East for Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. And we played music, especially during the holiday time, a lot of holiday carols, and brought a lot of good cheer to our troops and our partners and even some local communities. And it was really special to use the power of music to influence so many good folks in so many good ways.
And since then, you've gone on. You were in Colorado Springs for a bit. Then you were the band of the Golden West. And tell us now about the post that you're commanding.
I commissioned in 2008 to be a commissioned officer. I didn't have any plans to do that, but my boss at the time said to think about it, so I became a band leader. Just a few months ago, I've come here to the greater St. Louis area, to Scott Air Force Base down here, and it's the United States Air Force Band of Mid-America, which I'm currently commanding. 64 unbelievable airmen musicians, highly trained, and very strong musicians.
You have several bands and ensembles on your base. Tell us about some of the folks that you have in the different ensembles.
That's very true, and we either all come together for one big marching band, or we can break down as far as to one individual musician, perhaps a singer to perform the national anthem, or a bugler to perform taps. But we also have a couple of woodwind quintets, brass quintets, jazz ensembles, concert and show bands, as well as pop and country music groups full-time. So we can pretty much run the gamut of any current musical style, and certainly leaning back into our history. And I think we have 9 performing ensembles. We also have kind of a folk rock group as well, which is one of our newest.
Well, we're very excited because in February, early February, you are going to be bringing the Midwest Winds Woodwind Quintet to Iowa. So tell us about that ensemble.
The Midwest Winds is a highly eclectic group. It's a traditional woodwind quintet with bassoon, horn, oboe, flute, and clarinet, all unbelievably virtuosic musicians and great personalities. And one of our missions here is to tour through our region, which includes 10 states, Iowa, which is one of them. And this particular tour takes them through to Iowa State and up to Cedar Falls and University of Northern Iowa and a couple of public school appearances. And they play traditional woodwind quintet literature, perhaps Beethoven. And then also, they're a little bit entertaining. A lot of times, a woodwind quintet can be thought of as more of a like a recital ensemble, but this group and most of the groups in the Air Force, not only do they take the music and take it very seriously, but they're also very entertaining.
Tell us about some of the pieces that they're going to be pulling out of their bags to perform on this tour.
Well, the most current list is, as I know it, I know that they are performing Beethoven's Opus 4, arranged by Mordecai Rechtman. And they also have a Klugart Quintet, Opus 79, which is very good. I've heard them perform that before, and that's really going to knock the listener's socks off. And the music they're performing on this particular tour spans three centuries, which is quite remarkable, the flexibility of a group like that. And I think they'll play a couple marches. They've listed for me Barnum and Bailey's favorite by Iowa's own Carl King, and take a full marching band size piece and arrange it down to five instrumentalists. They're definitely going to be busy with Carl King's Barnum and Bailey's favorite.
So when you were a young man growing up in Clinton, Iowa, did you think that you would grow up and be the commander of 65 musicians?
Never once did I think that when I was growing up that I would wear first a military uniform, much less an Air Force uniform, and be a band commander and a band leader for such amazing professionals. Nope, I never would have guessed it. I thought maybe I'd be a music teacher in small town Iowa, and I did do that for a couple of years down in Centerville, of course.
So do you play still now on anything? I mean, maybe you've traded in your trumpet for something else.
No, I do still play trumpet. I have recently played trumpet for the Air Force. If we're short of a few trumpet players, I have been known to fill in from time to time. And I do try to play in the local area when my schedule allows. So I feel very fortunate that I get to do that. And I've also recently picked up guitar, I guess, for the last 10 or so years. Most everybody else in the military, in the Air Force bands, their primary instrument, they play that, but they also play about three or four other things as well. So it's definitely challenging when we're at work and when we get to do music, because we play our normal instruments, or I'm a conductor for the big groups, but then you look in the practice rooms and normally you see your bassoonist playing saxophone, or you have a flutist that is also maybe working on trumpet, or a tuba player that plays bass. So very multifaceted and always looking for a new challenge.
The U.S. Air Force Band of Mid-America Commander and Conductor, Captain Jason Plosh, talking about the Midwest Winds Woodwind Quintet's upcoming Iowa concerts and masterclasses. All of their concerts are free and open to the public, except the Arts Center, which is a ticketed event. The U.S. Air Force Midwest Winds Woodwind Quintet will perform on February 2nd at the Martha Ellen Tye Recital Hall on the Iowa State campus at 7:30 p.m. Iowa Public Radio's Performance Iowa series will host the Woodwind Quintet for a short live IPR classical performance at noon on February 3rd. The evening of February 3rd, they will perform a recital at 8 at the University of Northern Iowa's Davis Hall. On February 4th, they will work with students in the Webster City School District. On February 5th at 6 p.m., they will perform prior to the Oscar-nominated short films at the Des Moines Arts Center. And on February 6th, they will complete their tour with a 1 p.m. recital at Drake University. Also at Drake University on January 22nd through the 24th, the Drake Opera Theater will be presenting Kurt Weill's Threepenny Opera at the Harmon Fine Arts Center. Don't go away, renowned pianist Andre Watts talks about Bernstein and his Young People's Concerts. Guest stage director William Farrar goes behind the scenes with the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's production of Mozart's Don Giovanni. And the brilliant young soprano Sydney Mancasola talks about her upcoming recital in Des Moines. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
Recitals are pretty infrequent, and actually I had the pleasure of being able to come to my hometown and do one here about a year ago, or less than a year ago, I should say. And it's such a lovely experience for me, and a very rare one for singers these days, especially as young as me. And I feel like I've been very fortunate to have a few opportunities to give recitals. I think you learn a lot about yourself as an artist when you give a recital, because it's a whole evening of you. And it's one thing to stand up and sing a couple arias or even sing a role. I mean, there's only a certain amount that you can present within that. But if you're putting together a recital, it really is a little taste of your likes and dislikes as a singer. And you really have to challenge yourself to inhabit all these different characters of all these different songs and keep people interested in an age where people aren't used to sitting for a full hour and a half and listening to a recital program. So I'm really thrilled to be able to do that. I think it's a wonderful challenge. And I'm also excited, hopefully, to see some friendly faces from the summer in Iowa and reconnect with some of the people who I grew to enjoy this summer. And I'm just also very happy that I can be giving this recital in Iowa. It's just a big treat for me, so I'm very excited.
The Des Moines Metro Opera Guild's guest soprano, Sydney Mancasola. Sydney is a 2013 Grand Finals winner of the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions. Last summer, she performed as the Countess Adele in the Des Moines Metro Opera's production of Rossini's La Comtesse. She's returning to Iowa on January 11th to present a recital. Sydney has always loved music.
I played the violin at a very young age. I started studying music when I was 2 years old. Violin was my first instrument, and I was very dedicated to it. It was a big part of my life, and my brother and my sister also played, and it was kind of a huge part of our family culture. So classical music was something that was very familiar to me. And then when I became about 13, I think, my violin teacher passed away, and it caused me to sort of switch it up because I couldn't find another teacher that I enjoyed as much, and we were quite close to him, and at that age I think it was just a little bit tough to continue with my violin studies. And I had always been into the stage and theater, and I was kind of a little bit of a stage animal when I was a kid. I danced and things like that. And so when I found opera, it kind of combined all of my passions. It was a great fit. And I think I knew by the time I was somewhere in high school or around that age that I was going to be doing this for a long time. So after high school, I applied to a lot of different conservatories and got accepted to a few. And Oberlin was my top choice. So I decided to go there and spent 4 years in Ohio in the snow, which was good because it kept me very focused. And after that, I moved to Philadelphia to continue my studies at the Academy of Vocal Arts, where I just graduated last year.
And last year also was a big year for you because of your Met auditions.
Yeah, it was great to be on the East Coast after my undergrad education because it gave me an opportunity to do a lot of different competitions, and the Met Council was one of them, and it ended up all working out very well. And there's a great system in place for, you know, helping fund young singers in their early careers through these competitions, and so I was trying to take advantage of that to have some money set aside for my studies, and I was lucky enough to win a couple competitions, and that was one of them.
Well, that's quite a competition to win. And just last summer, you were in Iowa thrilling audiences with your performances. Tell us about that.
Oh, it was a great experience. I remember finding out that Des Moines would be doing La Comtesse, which is a Rossini opera that's not done super often, but is gaining some popularity. And I knew that it was an opera that I really wanted to sing. It's a role that is so much fun, and the story was so much fun. And I knew that Des Moines Metro Opera had a really good reputation for being a company that likes to hire young singers and also that does really great work. So I was just thrilled when it worked out. And the whole experience was so wonderful. Everyone in the company was so great to work with, and they hired great singers, which always makes it so much easier. And I was very, very impressed by the company itself.
And you also made your Iowa Public Television debut. They filmed it, and it was on public television here, and then also we carried it on Iowa Public Radio, which was great. So thank you for letting that happen.
Yeah, it's always nice when it's not over after the last final curtain.
Tell us, in addition to the Met Opera National Council auditions, tell us some other awards that you've won.
There's one in California. It's called the Lorraine L. Zachary Competition, and I was able to have the top prize in that, and then also the Jurda Listener Competition in New York, and I won the top prize in that. And then the Houston Grand Opera did a competition, and I think I got the second place award in that one. But they were all in 2013, so it was kind of a good, fortunate, lucky year for me. It was nice to be able to take care of it all at once.
Now you have your plate full for this next season. Tell us about some of the things that you have upcoming.
My next job, I'm doing a Messiah in Baltimore in just about a week when I fly back to Philadelphia. And that's always a nice way to bring in the holidays with the piece that we all have grown to love. And then I will be going to Florida for quite a while. I'm singing Layla and the Pearl Fishers at Florida Grand Opera. And then right after that, I will be doing Marie and La Fille du Régiment at Palm Beach Opera. And then after about a month off, I returned to St. Louis, which is a company I did some time with as a young artist. They've hired me now as a main stage artist, and I will be singing Lisette in La Rondine. And that's kind of what's coming up in the near future for me.
And you're also going to be doing the Knoxville somewhere along the line?
Yeah, that's actually something I just completed. I got to go out to the Sun Valley Symphony, which is in Idaho. It's a beautiful, beautiful location, and they have a lovely little music festival there in the summers. And they're actually all free concerts, which is beautiful. There's a lot of support from the donors and things, so they've been able to make the whole concert free, and I was able to sing that piece, which was a new piece for me and is absolutely gorgeous. I just loved singing it, so it was a great experience.
On January 11th, you're going to be performing back in Des Moines, so thank you very much for coming back. And that will be at the Cathedral Church of St. Paul. Tell us about what you're going to be presenting at that recital.
Well, we're still actually just twisting and turning it around a little bit to make sure we have the perfect recital, but I'm thinking about singing some French songs. I love to sing in French. I'm thinking about doing a song by Debussy, a song by Duparc, and a song by Delibes, which are three songs that I've sort of used a few times in recital that I like a lot. I think it really shows the different styles of French art songwriting, and they're very different but sort of have some similarities in the language and the textures. So it's a nice little study in French art song. And then another thing that I'm presenting is a set by Bellini, because I think it's always nice to have some nice Italian bel canto style singing on the program. And then the other sections aren't completely set yet, but I'm considering a few arias, one from Manon by Massenet, which is a role that I got to complete last year and just adore, and hope to sing for some of the Iowa audience. And then also I may be singing some selections from the operetta repertoire, and then I also may be presenting some songs in English, some popular American songs, something like Somewhere Over the Rainbow or I'll Be Seeing You. I always like to present something that's a little more accessible and reminds people of things, sort of provides a nostalgic atmosphere for people.
Guest soprano Cindy Mancasola. Cindy will perform in recital next Sunday, January 11th at 1:30 p.m. at the Cathedral Church of St. Paul in Des Moines with collaborative pianist Jody Goble. Tickets may be ordered at DesMoinesMetroOpera.org or 515-961-6221. Tickets will also be available at the door. Westminster Presbyterian Church of Des Moines will present a fully staged version of Stravinsky's L'Histoire du Soldat on Saturday, January 31st at 7 p.m., and again on Sunday afternoon, February 1st at 3 p.m. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. Just ahead, insight into one of Mozart's most famous operas, Don Giovanni. And the Des Moines Civic Music Association celebrates their 90th anniversary season by presenting in recital one of the world's finest pianists, Andre Watts.
My mother went to Austria to go to school, and, you know, the war came, and she couldn't get back to Hungary, so she went into Germany, and she was a displaced person in Germany. And she met my father, and he was in the army, and that was that.
So you ended up growing up in the United States. You made your debut when you were just 9 years old. Tell us about this.
Well, about 10. I lived in Germany until my father got transferred back to the States. And then I lived in Philadelphia, and I auditioned with many other children. And there were other winners every year. Little children played with the Philadelphia Orchestra in those years. Anyway, and I won when I was 9. Actually, the performance was when I was 10 years old. And I played Haydn D Major Piano Concerto with Samuel Antek, was the assistant conductor then. And so that was my first, I guess it was my first public performance.
You went on to study with Leon Flesher, and then you had an amazing debut experience. Tell us about that.
Well, I was studying with a woman named Genia Robinor, and one day she announced to my mother and me that she, unbeknownst to us, had written in to the New York Philharmonic asking to audition for the Young People's Concerts. And so then I was accepted as one of the contestants, and she presented us with this thing that, like, well, in 2 weeks we're going to go to New York and you're going to audition. So we went, and I auditioned, and Bernstein was not at the preliminaries. It was Helen Coates, who was actually a former piano teacher of his and was his general sort of factotum, and the three assistant conductors. And I played, and they all stood up, and we thought, even my teacher, who was an intelligent woman, thought, why, they're really so nice. They stand up and, you know, applaud for everybody, because we didn't really think I played that great. And so we figured, well, that means probably I got to the next round. And the finals were in what was then Philharmonic Hall, which is now Avery Fisher Hall. And there was Bernstein. And I think people forget that, there were three other winners on that program. Fabulous young pianists. They happened to be all, I say, girls. I mean, maybe not politically correct now, but trust me, I was a boy and they were girls. None of us was grown up. And they shared a Mozart concerto on this program. But the big hoopla came because Bernstein, on the broadcast, on the television broadcast, said, well, I'm going to have the pleasure of conducting for this boy, myself, and so forth and so on. So actually, I had recording offers already and concert offers based on the Young People's Concerts. But then in January of 63, Glenn Gould canceled. So they couldn't find any, famous pianists. And Frank Milburn, who was the artistic administrator, suddenly they were having a meeting, trying to find out who they could get. And he said, well, why don't we get that kid back? And, Bernstein thought, oh, that's a fabulous idea. And so I got a call on a Tuesday morning. It was Carlos Mosley, who was the general manager. And he said, well, would you like to come down and play Thursday night and Friday afternoon with us again? And so one of the reasons that that became such a big deal was because there was a newspaper strike. And because there was a newspaper strike, all the giant periodicals, who would never have sent anyone to cover, something like this, Newsweek, Time, Ebony, Life, they all sent people. And it was sort of, a big success. And so they all did stories. And so that was the beginning of my playing concerts professionally.
And quite a beginning. Then you have also gone on and done several things on television and being like the first solo recitalist to present a Live from Lincoln Center concert and then one during prime time.
Yes. Well, look, it was the time of that. So, that's when people say being in the right place at the right time. The early years of my career were very involved with television, starting with this, appearance on the Young People's Concerts. But then, the first live full-length recital, and then we did one in prime time. And, this was at the height of the Live from Lincoln Center series and the early years of that. And a lot more things were possible then than are now.
You're going to be appearing on January 31st at Cheslow Auditorium on the Drake campus in Des Moines, and you have a marvelous recital plan. Tell us about the works that you will be performing. It opens with two sonatas by Scarlatti.
Yes. You know, I think pianists fall into two groups. You know, pianists who like to come and start a program with the shorter pieces, or the opposite. Somebody wants to come out and start with a, you know, 40-minute piece. So I like to play Scarlatti at the opening of recitals fairly often. And the first of these two is sort of like a pastoral type of sonata. And then the contrasting sort of repeated note hilarity of Scarlatti in the second one. And then the Mozart A minor Rondo, which is, if not the most, certainly one of the few most chromatic. And when I say romantic, I don't mean in the Chopinesque sense, but just in the forward looking from the classical style, pieces that Mozart wrote. It's a really great work. I mean, it's in its own way a kind of little, almost like opera scene. And then Beethoven Sonata, Opus 10, Number 3. That sonata is the first of the genuinely heavy-duty slow movements in the Beethoven sonatas, of which there are many. Written, he was still a young, relatively young man, but just at this time came to the full realization that he was going deaf and that there was no recourse. Even the heading of the movement, of the second movement of this sonata, Largo e Mesto, unusual and sad, to say largo and sad. It's a rather extreme. It's a great, great piece of music. And then, in the second half, we have Liszt and Chopin, some Chopin etudes and G minor ballade, and Liszt, Un Sospiro, and some of my favorite pieces, which are the later works, which are, you know, Liszt was, in his way, a very revolutionary composer. Even the Lugubre Gondola, there are two of these. I mean, you know, Wagner died in Venice, and Liszt was in Venice some, I think, a couple months before. And anyway, Liszt had a dream that he went out on his hotel balcony and looked down, and there was a funeral gondola, and when it came by the canal under his balcony, Wagner was in it. And Wagner was still alive when he had this dream. However, some months later, Wagner did die, and was everything in the dream sort of came true. So it was one of these precognitive situations. And Liszt wrote about it, and it's a really great piece. So that gives you an overview of the program, I think.
So what's it like to go to a place and just sit down and have to play an instrument that you haven't played on before?
Well, it's always an adventure. And full of surprises, and, you know, as they say, comes with the territory. I mean, it's not really true. You almost never walk on stage and sit down at an instrument that you have not played. You know, presumably you got to practice on it, if not the day before, certainly the day of the concert. But the problem is, instruments are, you know, like human beings. They're inherently, you know, graceful, clumsy, surly, elegant, kind, unkind, you know, whatever. Even the greatest technician cannot really alter the basic nature of an instrument. My mother used to say, well, good pianist sounds good even on a bad piano, which is a rather cruel statement, but there is some truth to it.
Pianist extraordinaire Andre Watts. Mr. Watts won't have to worry about his Des Moines Civic Music and Drake University recital piano. They plan on having two concert grands, a Steinway and a Yamaha, tuned and waiting for him to select the one he likes best. Hats off to the Des Moines Civic Music, not only for being the oldest arts organization in Des Moines, but also for 90 years of bringing world-class musical experiences to our state. To learn more about Mr. Watts' Saturday evening, January 31st, 7:30 p.m. recital in Cheslow Auditorium on the Drake University campus, please go to civicmusic.org or call 515-280-4020. Just ahead, the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's guest stage director, William Ferrara, reveals his take on Mozart's Don Giovanni. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
interested in the spiritual quest of Don Giovanni. To me, he's this bad boy that we love to hate, this very corrupt, womanizing rake who is trying to find the ultimate sin. It's like he's in search of sin, in search of the ultimate blasphemy that will make God or divine judgment show itself. He's a jaded, decadent nobleman, bored with the world, and in that way, very much an Enlightenment figure. You know, both Da Ponte and Mozart were Masons and very interested in the ideals of the Enlightenment at that time, a more scientific understanding of the world and a rejection of all the traditional institutions of church and state and so on. And Don Giovanni is a wonderful sort of working out of those ideas. So in our production, we are using traditional period costumes, because I think that the story is very much something of that moment. It was written in 1787. That's right before the French Revolution. And there's lots of political comment in the show. So traditional costumes, but in a rather modern kind of setting. When Don Giovanni is dragged down to hell, we have sort of a zombie apocalypse of all these spirits of hell oozing out of the ground. So I'm trying to balance or bring out a whole variety of themes in the production.
Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's guest stage director from the University of Oklahoma School of Music, William Ferrara. William has been a stage director and teacher for more than 30 years, having directed and taught not only in America, but across the globe. Prior to teaching in Oklahoma, he taught at UNI. Last year, he published the book Staging Scenes from the Operas of Mozart. William delves into Mozart's legendary Don Giovanni.
It's based largely on a play by Tirso de Molina, a Spanish playwright in the Renaissance, about Don Juan, this very famous myth or story, Don Juan and the Stone Guest. And actually, Molière wrote a Stone Guest play also. If you remember the story, the opera begins with a murder and a rape. Don Juan, Don Giovanni, sneaks into the house of the Commendatore and attempts to rape the Commendatore's daughter, Donna Anna. When the Commendatore comes to Donna Anna's defense, Don Giovanni murders him. And so it is Donna Anna's quest for revenge that drives the plot of the opera. Well, later in the opera, when Giovanni is fleeing a search posse, he jumps over a wall in the alleys of Seville, and he is in a graveyard. And there is the memorial statue of the Commendatore. And as this act of bravado or blasphemy, he invites the statue to dinner. Well, the statue nods and says, yes, he will come. And then the final scene of the opera is the statue, in fact, coming to dinner. And he tells Giovanni he needs to repent. And Giovanni is unwilling to repent. And the Commendatore drags Giovanni down to hell. Well, this story has been part of our world, part of our culture for hundreds of years. And I think Da Ponte really had a genius for knowing what would inspire Mozart. He was wonderful at condensing the action and creating these situations and characters that would inspire Mozart's greatest music. Da Ponte himself was quite a bad boy. He was a man of the church, an ordained deacon, and he was a friend of Casanova, the famous playboy. And apparently they would go to brothels together. Anyway, Da Ponte was kicked out of one country after another in Europe. He was a poet, and he served at the court of several royal families. And he ended up actually emigrating to the United States. He founded the Department of Italian Literature at Columbia in New York City. So this is a wonderful collaboration, Da Ponte and Mozart, one of the famous artistic collaborations in history. They wrote together Le Nozze di Figaro just the year before in 1786, which premiered in Vienna. But things were getting a little too hot in their revolutionary fervor, and so Giovanni was premiered in Prague in 87. And then they also collaborated on Così fan tutte in 1791, the year of Mozart's death. So a wonderful collaboration indeed.
Well, in addition to Don Giovanni's escapades, there's also these side stories that accompany that overall plot where you have his trying to seduce all the women all the time.
Yes, and I think that is really an attempt on Giovanni's part to find the most heinous crimes he can. He chooses women that are very fragile. Donna Anna is mentally very, very fragile. Zerlina is a peasant girl that he tries to seduce on the very eve of her wedding, just being as impossibly profane as he can. And then, of course, there's Donna Elvira. Elvira is a wonderful, fiery, passionate woman who's out to save Don Giovanni's soul. She considers herself married to Giovanni, is a very religious woman, and she sees these spirits of hell coming to get Giovanni, and she wags her Bible and tries to prevent his damnation, tries to get him to repent, and he just laughs at her, of course. So it's a very fun opera. You know, De Ponte actually called it a drama giocoso, a joking or a facetious comedy. So it's sort of a black comedy, really. It's full of contradictions like this. For instance, Mozart uses the most lovely music for the most sinister purposes. Now, most people know the tune La ci darem la mano. La ci darem la mano. You hear it in commercials all the time. This is a lovely tune, but it's used for Don Giovanni to seduce the peasant girl, Zerlina. It's wonderful music in this opera. It's so mysterious and dark and compelling, full of very intimate psychological portraits of these characters.
What about Leporello?
Oh, he's a wonderful character. He's the servant to Don Giovanni, and he has this love-hate relationship with him. He sort of is this dipso alcoholic, and he keeps a catalog of Don Giovanni's seductions and crimes. I imagine it's illustrated as well. He loves watching Giovanni have sex, and he keeps track of all of this. And he kind of wants to be Don Giovanni. He wants the high life, the drinking, the women, the partying. It's the first thing he says in the opera is that he wants to be like a nobleman, and yet he hates Giovanni. He wants to get away from him. He feels like he's being morally corrupted as well, and he's very frightened throughout the opera, and he sees the gates of hell just as clearly as Elvira does, and he wants to get away. I think it's a wonderful portrait of the dependency of the lower classes on the aristocracy at this point. I mean, you could even look at the whole opera in those political ways, that Don Giovanni represents the ancient aristocracy, so decadent and corrupting. And Zerlina and Mazzetto, the peasant couple, are these abused peasants. In fact, Don Giovanni beats up Mazzetto at some point, and he tries to rape Zerlina. And of course, Leporello, so loving and dependent on his master and hating him at the same time. And you could see in the other characters various aspects of society that are being destroyed by the corrupt aristocracy. Donna Elvira representing religion, the Commendatore representing government and the state. And I think this is something that at that moment the audience would have understood. They were primed to understand these kinds of political and social themes. In fact, there's a magnificent moment in the opera in the finale of Act One in the ballroom where the aristocrats come forward and everybody joins in this great chorus of Viva la Libertà, this cry for democracy and republican liberty. And I'm sure the crowd in Prague in 1787 went wild at that moment. It's sort of a moment outside of the opera, almost as if the whole opera company and audience were standing up together to cry for liberty. It's an exciting moment.
Tell us about some of the special spots that you particularly like in this opera.
Well, I love the overture. It's curious to me that Mozart didn't write very much music for Don Giovanni himself. There are these magnificent arias for all the other characters that delve deeply into their personality and their relationships. But Don Giovanni, I suppose because in some ways he's soulless, he's not conflicted like the other characters are, he's sort of pure. Mozart didn't write really any music for him. There's a very superficial serenade that he sings. Actually, he's dressed as Leporello when he sings that. So to me, the music for Don Giovanni is in the overture. And so I've decided to stage the overture, you know, that magnificent, thundering, minor chord overture that we all know so well, reminiscent of hell and damnation. And then the overture moves into this bright and happy and very active allegro. We even hear the footsteps of the statue coming to get Don Giovanni in the overture. Interestingly, Tirso di Molina set the supper, this famous supper that Don Giovanni has where the statue comes to dinner. He sets it in a church, on the church altar, and I decided to use that. So as a blasphemy, Don Giovanni is going to be whoring and eating his chicken and drinking his wine on the church altar, using the chalice, you know, the communion chalice for his wine, as blasphemous as possible. And that's when the commendatore comes in to drag him to hell. So I thought I'd begin the opera with that very idea that Giovanni runs into this church, he's laughing at God, and then he sees from the shadows of the church his sins, these sort of demons from hell. He sees their shadows coming to get him. But he laughs them off, and he has this wonderful party on the altar. And we see the various characters of the opera coming into the church. And it's a way of introducing the characters and the musical themes of the opera. So I love the overture. And then my other favorite scene has got to be the end of the opera, where Mozart uses the same music from the beginning of the overture for the entrance of the commendatore, the stone guest, the statue, who comes, this wonderful bass voice, the statue comes to demand Giovanni's repentance. It's a thrilling moment in the theater.
The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's guest stage director, William Ferrara. The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater under Daniel KleinConnect will present Mozart's Don Giovanni on Friday evening, January 16th at 8 p.m. and again on Sunday afternoon at 2 at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids. For more information and details on purchasing tickets, please go to cr-opera.org. Iowa Public Radio's Performance Iowa will broadcast highlights from Don Giovanni with seven of the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater star singers on Tuesday, January 13th at noon. We hope you can join us for that special broadcast. Today's Iowa Arts Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Sarah Compton, Don Simonson, Jason Plosh, Cindy Mancasola, Andre Watts, and William Ferrara. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner and Phil Moss. Thanks for the show also goes to IPR's Jason Burns and Garrett Van Leeuwen and music director Al Scherz. Program research was provided by Nick Carlo, Scott Bosco, and Stacia Fortunes. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.